And I'd ask you to please help me welcome Don M. from Laguna Beach as our speaker tonight.
Good evening, my name's Don, I'm an alcoholic. Who's grateful to be alive, sober, and free on a Saturday night? All right, I love the life. You want to be alive, you got to be awake, right? I want to thank the Orchid speaker meeting for asking me to come out and share my story. And I've always felt it's an honor and a privilege to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really like the feel here, and I really loved the pokey tonight. And I want to thank John for encouraging us to try that. And it was fabulous. And the little potluck that we had going on, and I got to meet people, and I got to see some old friends. Caitlin, I'm really glad to run into you, and Lee, it's great to see you too, and I'm meeting new friends as we go along, so this is awesome, and congratulations to all the birthday celebrants and the chip takers. I want to welcome anyone who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous, those that didn't identify, and maybe anybody who's coming back. Did anybody ever come back to Alcoholics Anonymous? You came back and said AA didn't work? And then we found out, you know, AA works if we have a proper attitude and work at it, right? It says it in our book. Because if I'm trying to control and enjoy my drinking and I'm not enjoying it anymore, it's like, welcome home. My self-knowledge and willpower have failed me again, and I succumb to the drink again, welcome home. And if I'm running around in those bedevilments sober, welcome home. But if you're desperate and you're tired and you're drinking against your will, welcome to a way of living that works. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. All we ask that you do here is grab someone's hand who has a working knowledge of this big book and has had a spiritual experience. Because there's a power that is accessible and we can never be separated from it. You see, I came here powerless. That means without power. Lack of power is our dilemma. We had to find a power in which to live. And there is no human power that could relieve us of our alcoholism. There's one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. And it says it's urgent. Now is urgent. So grab someone's hand who's had an experience through this book. Because really, this is just information on how to gain access to that power. And then it's up to us to put it in, you know, to put it into application. To bring about the transformation. And then be a demonstration. My sobriety date is April 16th, 1994. I have a sponsor and I have a home group. And that home group is the women's meeting at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach at 6 p.m. on a Thursday night. Now, we don't have a meeting name. Well, we kind of do. We just, we call ourselves the Sluts. And that's because it's an acronym for Sober Ladies Using the Steps. Ladies, so if you're ever in the area, come on by, you could be a slut too. But my friend Mary always says, she says, I came in as a slut and I became a slut. And I'm like, me too. I truly believe that every sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous is a demonstration of God's power to change a human being. But how do we change? We use the essentials of recovery that's found in the spiritual experience, this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The H-O-W of this program, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. But I believe that willingness is the key, like it talks about in the third step of the 12 and 12. Because if I'm not willing to be honest, I'm not going to be honest. And if I'm not willing to be open-minded, I'm not going to be open-minded. And if I'm not willing to be willing, nothing is going to change for me. And nothing did change for me in my first year of sobriety. So let me tell you how I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I do that, I want to tell you a few things about me. When I was 12 years old, I had an epiphany on my parents' front porch. I knew deep within, deep in my soul, I knew three things about my life. Later on, when I would work with a sponsor, she'd tell me that was my intuitiveness, and intuitiveness is ultimately a connection to a God. But I don't know that yet, I'm 12. So I'm standing on my parents' front porch, and I knew three things. I knew I wasn't gonna have any kids, I knew that my 30s were gonna be great, and I knew that I was going to travel the world in a business suit, and I was going to carry a briefcase, and I was going to be much like Bill. I was going to be the head of a vast empire. I was going to manage with the utmost assurance, and I was going to prove to the world I was important. And I knew these three things at 12. And I went, huh, and I went on my merry way. I also believe that we are all born with this divine spark within us. And it's whether we fuel it or we smother it. And each and every time I took a drink, I dimmed the light of the spirit within. And I fuel it or I smother it. But I know that in the darkest of dark, there's always a pinpoint of light. And there is a power that is accessible, and we can never be separated from it. Try as I might, I didn't extinguish the light. I'm still here. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, not in his body. So let me tell you what I was thinking about between the ages of 12 and 15 when I took my first drink. So I'm a Whittier girl. And when I was coming up on the high school campus, there was the Socias, the Stoners, the rah-rah girls, the drill team, the band, and all that extracurricular stuff. And I never felt like I fit in. It's a common theme around here. I never felt like I fit in. I felt apart from. You know, our 12 and 12 talks about it, anxious apartness. I never felt like I was pretty enough to be in your social group. I wasn't musically talented enough to be in the band. And I wasn't coordinated enough to be in the drill team. And I just wasn't enough. I have no idea where that measuring stick came from, but I wasn't enough. I rode and showed horses on the weekend. I did really, really well. I won national titles. But there is not an equestrian group on campus in Whittier that I could fit into. I could tell you where I was and who I was with and what I drank. I was at the El Monte Auction. I was with a group of older friends. I was 15 years old, and I drank Southern Comfort right out of a bag. And let me tell you what Southern Comfort did. I get a few little recognition. It's like, oh, yeah. I took a swig of that Southern Comfort. It hit the pit of my stomach. It's like, boom, yes! And I loved the effect produced by alcohol that night. It quieted the comparison. It stopped the chattering and the comparison of my insides to your outsides. I am always usually running at a level of less than. And you add alcohol to this alcoholic body, and I come up to the playing field. And I'm flirtatious, and I'm fun, and I'm life of the party, game on. I need to do this again immediately. And I know what it talks about in that line, the doctor's opinion. It says they drink primarily for the effect produced by alcohol. I never knew that I was restless, irritable, and discontent unless I could again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You add alcohol. And I loved the effect produced by alcohol that night. And so I would continue to seek that, which it did for me, that sense of ease and comfort for the rest of my drinking career. So the first lie I tell was to the California DMV. I took my girlfriend's baptism certificate. I told him I was new to town and I need an ID to cash checks. I walked up to the counter. I signed her name and her birthday, let them take my picture, mailed it to my address. And I'm thinking, it's half legit. So now I'm starting to lie to my parents, and I'm telling them I'm going to the high school dances, the football games, anything to do with school. I'm lying about you. All know I've never been. I was at the Mississippi Moonshine Club in Downey. And I am not there to party, have fun, pick up. I am there to seek the relief that alcohol provided. It was like, prop me up, you know, put me in the corner, prop me up, give me a drink. I'm good. I need the relief. I love the effect. It's quiet, and it stops all the inside chatter. Now, alcohol doesn't do anything unless it does something for you. And I came out of high school pretty much unscathed, but during high school, I had a lot of warning signs. I had those consequences. I was coming in late, and you know, you get the restriction from your parents. You know, no allowance, can't use the family car. The family car had a few unexplained door dings, like the shopping cart hit it when I really actually hit a guardrail, you know, those kind of things. I'm drinking and driving. I have 1 foot in the window and 1 foot out of the window, and Dad says, are you coming or going? And at 17, there's really no right answer for 3 a.m. One time I was drinking in El Monte and I came to on a Sunday morning. I'd started drinking in El Monte on a Saturday night, and I came to Sunday morning in my house. I have no idea how I got there. And that morning I was reading this paper, and there was a little blurb in the paper, and it said that there was a fatal hit and run in El Monte. And I ran out to check my car to see if I had committed that crime, to see if there were any dents and blood and hair that I might have done that. And it wasn't me, and I was like, whew, all right, thank God. And, you know, so those are the things that are happening and starting to occur, and I'm still showing up to horse shows. I've got hangovers. You know, I'd snuck out the night before, and I'm still, you know, I probably still have alcohol coming through my bloodstream. and oozing out of my pores, but I don't take note to that. I was also voted the senior class clown. I didn't know that was a level of self-centeredness until I worked with a sponsor. She said, you know, any kind of attention you were getting, you know, it didn't matter, negative or positive, laughter or, abuse or whatever it was, you know, what we do in high school. Anyway, I was voted the senior class clown, but I was also the valedictorian. You see, I'm really, really, I can do really well academically, but socially I'm really inept. I just need a drink. But I'm the valedictorian, senior class clown, and I get out of high school. And one of the things in high school that's so paramount for me is that I never had a date in high school. I never went to the prom, and I never had a boyfriend. So I had never had any of those experiences. So I get out of high school. I'm 20 years old. I met a guy in January. I married him in August. Now, if you're thinking about doing that now, let's hope you have a sponsor. But I married him in August, and I didn't know how to do either. I've got my first corporate career job. And I've got this husband, and I'm 20 years old, and I'm trying to, do this job, and I've got this husband, my parents are married to this day. They've got 55 years of marriage under their belt, and I'm trying to mimic my parents because I have no gauge. I don't know what to do. You know, I've just got a husband. Later on, I would learn that when I was working with a sponsor, she'd tell me that I married the first man that ever paid attention to me. But in that time, I was doing the best I could. I was going to the grocery store at 6 a.m. and I'm getting all the groceries and I'm putting everything in the cart, and I come home, you know, I'd unload those at home, and then I'd load the car up and we'd go over to the laundromat, I went to the laundromat, and then I would do all the laundry. I'd fold it all up, put it in the car, and come home and unload it, and he's doing his dry goods on the couch. Now at this point, I've had a fake ID for 5 or 6 years and I had been burnt out of the bars. So I have petered off of my drinking. And he's still doing his dry goods on the couch, and I'm just trying to be this doting housewife and this career woman, and I'm doing the best I can. I'm trying to manage the show, and at 5 months into that marriage, that man came home with hickeys on his neck and chest and told me there were bruises from work. And out popped that measuring stick. And I'm not enough. I'm not pretty enough to be your wife. I'm not good enough to be your wife. I'm not talented enough to be your wife. You're seeking outside relations. And I don't know what to do. And I don't know where I attach shame to divorce, but I did not want to be the first divorce in the family. So I stayed. And for 7 more months, anytime that man walked out that front door, I became an ugly piece of work. And I start verbally assaulting him, physically assaulting him, and eventually I'm being escorted out of my own home. The police are escorting me out of my own home. Don't you know what he did to me? Don't you know what he did to me? To me. And I got self-pity and victim oozing out of my pores. You see, he might have just been going to 7-Eleven. He might have been going to his brother's house. And I am not a vision for you. On our 1-year anniversary, I had no idea what to get him for a gift. So I asked him for a divorce. And he obliged. She's like, I'm out. So we part ways, and I go on into my, and I move into my parents' house. And for 6 months, I cried myself to sleep. Poor, poor, poor me. Poor, poor, pitiful me. And one morning, I looked in the mirror, ladies, and you know what I'm talking about, those big puffy cry eyes? Not the booze eyes, the ones that you've been crying for 6 whole months? Those eyes. I looked in the mirror and I said, I am tired of feeling this way. I'm gonna kick ass all over this town. Pour me a drink. And I moved out and I moved into a roommate situation. Game on. I am drinking on Wednesday to prepare for Friday's happy hour. Saturdays, I'm drinking to oblivion. Sundays, I'm trying to taper off to get to work by Monday. Anybody ever notice that Jim shows up on Tuesday in the big book? You ever wonder what happened to Jim? I'm thinking he overshot the mark. Because I sure did. I was always coming in on Tuesday. I couldn't make it into Monday. No matter how hard I tried to stop drinking on Sunday, I couldn't. You know, in our book it says, when you want to quit entirely, you know, find you cannot quit entirely, or when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. If this be the case, you might be suffering from a spiritual illness, spiritual malady that only a spiritual experience will conquer, or something like that. I can't quote it right now, but But I couldn't stop. Once I took a drink, I couldn't stop. I couldn't get to work by Monday. So my solution to that was, my sponsor tells me, is my solution was, is that I just started dating the bosses. I was insuring my drinking, really. So I would go, I would date the bosses. You know, they would might be presidents or owners of businesses I'm working for, and they have no idea my capacity for drink. So, you know, I'd call in sick, and he'd send flowers. And then I would come in late. I'm dating the boss, and I got a good gig going on. And I start getting dripped with corporate credit cards and diamonds and sapphires and Movados. Oh my. I started traveling with him. We're going to New York, San Francisco. I can tell you a San Francisco story. So I level up when I'm dating the bosses, as you know, and I'm dating men of wealth. And so we're gonna go to the Bel Air Hotel on a date, and I don't have a dress of that caliber. So he says, well, let's fly up to San Francisco and we'll get you a dress. So we fly up to San Francisco and we go to the Embarcadero Center, and there's two Donna Karan dresses. I can't make a decision, so he buys both. And then he buys the Donna Karan sunglasses to go with that, and we come on home. Well, later on, the date comes around, and I show up to the Bel Air Hotel, and I'm really nervous. You see, my insides don't match your outsides, and I don't belong here in the Bel Air Hotel. And I order a drink. And I suck that one down, and then I order another drink, and I'm really nervous. And I spill that drink all over the white linen cloth and the cream-colored dress that I have on, and I am mortified, absolutely mortified that I've spilled a drink in this classy place called the Bel Air Hotel. So I want to back this up. Ladies, how many of you have drank before the date? How many of you have tried to control and enjoy your drinking while on the date? And then how many of you said, excuse me, I have to go to the restroom? And then you swing by that back bar and you throw a few shots back, or you make it to the bathroom and you pull the bottle out of your purse, take a few slugs of that, and then you come on back to the table and you say, I'll have a salad. And then you leave that date and you gotta go drink like you need to drink. But that's exactly what happened to me that night, that, you know, as it is all the time. But that night was at the Bel Air Hotel, and I gotta go drink like I need to drink. So I left the Bel Air Hotel, and I end up at the Pico Rivera Rim Ram Room, because that is how I like to drink. You see, the Pico Rivera Rim Ram Room has cork and mirror walls, it has patent leather seats, it's got barf in the bathroom and urine on the floor. And that is the way that I like to drink. And they talk about seeking lower companions, and I become the lower companion. But I don't see that yet. I just gotta drink. So I'm dating him, and I'm at the five-star hotel room in Hawaii. And our book talks about we are without sufficient force to bring into the consciousness the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And I can't drink away the guilt, shame, and remorse I got going on. It's not going away. And I'm on the bed listening to him on the phone with his wife one more time, giving her some lame excuse about where she's at, or where he's at. And I can't drink it away. And I'd like to stand here and tell you I did that once with one man. I'd like to stand here and tell you I did that twice with two men. I'd like to stand here and tell you I did that three times with three men. I have a huge wake of damage behind me with broken relationships and families in the wake of my past. It is not something I'm proud of. It is something I had to make right. Because I'm a female alcoholic, and I'll do anything I need to get what I want. And that's another drink. So we get, you know, that was a really great weekend. We ended on a high note, and when we got back, I couldn't do it anymore. And I called it off. And from this point forward, my life becomes very, very colorful. And I just start to shift my sights on something else. And I start coming to at the top of Mount Baldy, not knowing how I got there or who I was with. And I would come to, and I would look around, and I would only look for the bottle, because I knew it would be the only thing that would dissolve the knot in my stomach called fear. And then I was knocking on hotel room doors in Pomona. And now I'm starting to risk my life in the need of relief. And along this journey, a man named Jack showed up. And Jack, how many of you have moved in on the second date? Thank you for your honesty. You're carrying your toothbrush in your purse, extra set of clothes in your trunk. We just move on in. You know, Jack hung in there for 2 years, but, you know, during this relationship, has anybody ever come to in the middle of a field sobriety test? I had told the police officer that I could not perform this function because my equilibrium was off due to an inner ear infection. And I have no idea where that came from, but I went to jail that night. Has anybody ever come to in a city you didn't know existed? Well, I came to in La Palma. And La Palma is like 1.82 square miles. The police report says that they pulled me over because I was an obstruction of traffic because I was going 8 miles an hour trying to get somewhere. So during these DUIs, I have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go to Alcoholics Anonymous on the court card. And I come in here and I don't, you know, I'm listening to the differences, not the similarities. I come in here, get my court card signed, and I go on my merry way. I don't even listen to the lingo. I don't hear about rehab, detoxes, sober livings. I hear nothing. And I came in here and I listened to your stories. Yeah, that's true. I listened to your stories of pain. And I'm like, yeah, man, I drink too. And then I hear you share your stories of joy. And I'm like, absolutely, that's a reason to drink, you bet. And I didn't know you guys were sober. I thought it was just kind of a little congregation of people that came in and shared their escapades, but I didn't know you were sober. I had no clue what was happening. I got my court card signed because I said that's what they said I needed to do, and I went on my merry way. And now I know that when I come in here and you share your pain, it's divided amongst us. And then when you share your joy, it's multiplied by all of us. How was your wedding? How's your grandbaby? How was your holiday? And we become a fellowship. So I go on my merry way. Jack, Jack worked night and I worked days. And so I was drinking around the clock. I lived across the street from Surf Liquor. And this is a normal day. And this is, he is the first man that I ever admitted that I might have a problem with alcohol. Of course, two DUIs might have helped that out, but. Anyhow, so I told him I thought I had a problem with alcohol. But, you know, I didn't know that there were, you know, the obsession, the physical allergy, and the spiritual malady. You know, the obsession that this cocktail, this mix, this, it's all going to be, it's going to be right. This, you know, Southern Comfort vodka, Canadian mist, whatever, it's going to, this will be the right mix. And then I take a drink of that alcohol, and I can't stop. This is what it looks like. I'm drinking peppermint schnapps on the way to work because I know it smells like toothpaste. I have alcohol stashed underneath the passenger seat of my car. I have alcohol in my trunk. When I get to work, I have alcohol stashed in the right-hand side drawer of my desk. At lunchtime, I call up the Japanese bar and I tell her two words, Black Russian. And I get over there and she's got two lined up. I gun those down. Then I run over to Circle K. I grab a vodka bottle and a Circle K cup. And that is my afternoon drink. And on the way home, I've got bar tabs, liquor store tabs, and restaurant tabs on a 15-mile stretch from Santa Ana to Huntington Harbor. And when I got home, I had alcohol stashed in my shoe boxes, I have it in my suit pockets, I have it underneath my kitchen sink, and I end up having it in my toilet tank because I need alcohol to survive. And when I read that line in Bill's story and it said, liquor ceased to be a luxury and became a necessity, I knew exactly what it meant. Later on, I would learn that alcohol had become my master. Like I said, Jack only hung in there for 2 years. And he said, you know, I'm not going to, he called me up. He called me from work and he said, I'm not going to watch you kill yourself or anyone else. I'm leaving. And my only request was I wouldn't be there when he left. And when I got home, I realized he left the house I moved into. And I was left with a bedroom set. And he took everything else. Well deserved, it was his. And so, You know, our book talks about, we have about two alternatives. One is to blot out the consciousness of our intolerable situation the best I can, or accept spiritual help. I don't know there's help. Blot out the consciousness of my intolerable situation the best I can, or accept spiritual help. Rent, booze. Huntington Harbor is really expensive on a single income. She's laughing, yes ma'am. Huntington Harbor, booze. Rent, booze. I moved to Seal Beach. Seal Beach is an old town, a lot of money and a lot of booze and a lot of blackouts. I lived there for 2 years. I can tell you two things. Hennessy's and Main Street. That is it. I managed to hold a job. I do not know how. But I managed to hold on to a job. And on April 15th, 1994, I had blacked out one more night. I moved in with a roommate situation again, and I blacked out one more night. And my roommate and her boyfriend put me to bed. And I came to that next morning, and I'd had the DTs before, but I'd never had them this bad. And I could not stand fully erect, and I was shaking violently. And the only way I could get to the shower was to feel my way into the shower, you know, hunched over, trying to get into the shower. And when I got into that shower, when the water hit my body, it felt like I'd been hit by pellets and pins. Has anyone ever felt like that? And then when I went to wash my hair hurt, and I knew what would fix it, and it would be another drink. So I went down to the local liquor store, and I went and bought another bottle of Bacardi. And the rest of the story has been fed back to me by those involved. My employers broke into my house, they broke into my room, and they tapped me on the shoulder and they said, pack your bags, you're going somewhere. And I believe that God used them as a channel to get to me. And I believe that that was the hand of God that touched me that day, because for a moment, I was instantly sober. Some people like to call that the moment of clarity. But for me, it was that moment where the truth hit my soul. And I had no fight. The gig was up. I asked no questions. And I dutifully followed direction. I started to pack a duffel bag and I put my bottle of Bacardi in there because I had no idea what was happening. I just followed direction. Again, I asked no questions and they said, get in the car. So I got in the car. And you know, our book talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I just told you a few of the highlights. I did not tell you any of my lowlights. And being escorted into a detox by my employers was that moment of my pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that was in full effect. Being escorted by one employer on one arm, one boss on one arm, and one boss on the other. You know, they talk about there are no dues or fees here. Yes, there are. I paid them out there. I paid. You see, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, the acronym for that is PAID. And I paid a huge price. I'm a female alcoholic and I'll do anything I need to get what I want. And so I got in and they said, go through the door, and I went. And so when I got in there, they were doing my intake and they found my Bacardi and I was really mad. And I had no idea what was happening. They said, well, listen, do you have any parents? And I said, well, yeah, they moved out of state like 27 years ago. And they said, well, why don't you give them a call and let them know where you are? And I said, it's okay, I got this handled. It's all right, I'm good. And they said, well, listen, you know, you're gonna be here for a minute. They might wanna know where you are. And I said, I got this handled. I'm trying to manage my life in detox. And she says, well, listen, why don't you give them a call? So I finally succumbed and I called my mom and dad and I said, Mom, Daddy, you're sitting down? And they said, yeah, we're sitting down. I said, listen, I'm in a detox for alcohol. Oh my God, Dawn, where are you? I don't know. And she said, we'll find out, we'll see, you know, fly down, assess the situation, see how we can help you. You know, let us know where you are. And so I said, well, where am I? They said, you're at New Beginnings at Clark and Candlewood in Lakewood. And I said, Mom, Dad, they told me I'm at New Beginnings at Clark and Candlewood in Lakewood. And my mom said, At Clark and Candlewood in Lakewood? I said, that's what they said. And she said, Don, in 1964, you were born there. It was Lakewood General Hospital at the time. And I hope in that moment where the truth is hitting my soul and the chills are going up and down my legs, I hope that never stops. Because that was another moment where God was getting my attention. And I figured, this place is called New Beginnings. I can get a new lease on life. I can get a new beginning on life if I just stayed. So I stayed. And 2 weeks later, the insurance kicked me out. But I will always be forever grateful to Bill and Bob, who talked about attraction, not promotion. Her name was Eileen, and Eileen ran the aftercare program. And I was not required to attend that aftercare program, not by my employers, not by my my insurance company, no one. I was not required to attend it, but she was one that I was attracted to what she had. You see, she had a genuine, authentic smile. She had an inner peace that radiated out. She was happy. You didn't even have to ask her. You could see it. You could feel it because she vibrated, and I wanted what she had. So I sat next to her week after week after week, thinking I'd get it by transference. I had no idea there was work involved. What I'd been doing was fellowshipping. And please don't get me wrong, the fellowship will support us, but the steps change us. The fellowship will cure the loneliness of alcoholism, but it will not produce the entire psychic change that is promised us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The steps do that. So, I got a sponsor. Here's what happened. I'm 1 year sober. I'm 1 year sober, physically sober. I'm sober! And I had laid the alcohol down. I had no idea that I was still, mentally and spiritually suffering. That I had a spiritual malady. I just put the, physical, laid the alcohol down. So I'm 1 year sober. I'm on the phone with another alcoholic. I said, if this is what sobriety's all about, I don't want any part of it. I am a miserable bitch. I can't stand this. This sucks. I don't like it. And on the phone on that night, there was a suggestion. Why don't you get a sponsor? Why don't you go to some women's meetings? Why don't you work the steps? And why don't you get involved in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and your life will change? And on the phone on that night, my willingness was born and I was all in. Admit one. Fully conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. Absolutely. Now I know that I'm suffering from a threefold disease, spiritual, mental, and physical. I'd only did the physical. So what happens for me is I get this sponsor and I start to do this stuff and I have a quite a distance in my travels for work, and so I start glomming on to the cassettes at the time. They weren't 8-tracks, but they were cassettes. CDs now, MP3s. Anyway, I will always be forever grateful for those that take the time and volunteer their services and do all the recordings, because they helped people like me who had a great distance to travel for work. And I was listening to these CDs, and two speakers broke down the steps in a manner in which I heard. And they said, one is me, two is God, three is me and God, four and five is me, six and seven is God, eight and nine is you, 10 is me, 11 is God, and 12 is you, and there is no one else to play with. So let's get stepping. And then the other speaker said, broke it down in this manner. One is, I am the problem. Two is, come to believe there's a solution. Three is a decision to seek that solution. 4 through 9 take care of the past. 10 takes care of our daily life. 11 takes care of our spiritual life. And 12 takes care of our spiritual life. AA is the way I live. It is not something I do or attend. It is the way I live. Because I can come up here and talk a good game. How you living outside the walls? How you treating the elderly? How are you treating the 7-Eleven clerk? Are you kind, patient, loving, and tolerant? Are you living a spiritually disciplined life out there? How you living? So I start to get active in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I could see what happens for me is I had come out of a religion at 13 years old that I did not understand, nor did I believe in. And I would come into you, and I believed in this big God, but I just told you what I was doing out there. And I didn't believe that I was worthy of God's love. And so I come in here, and I'm starting to watch you, and I'm starting to watch everything about you. And whatever's working for you, could it possibly work for me? Because you were technically my hope in human form. And I start to watch you, and you know, that book has the chapter called We Agnostics, and I will always be grateful for that chapter, because they knew. It says, you know, it says, well, you lay aside a prejudice and express even a willingness. Cast aside an old idea, welcome in something new. It's woven all through that chapter. And it says, no matter your limited conception. And so I'd start to come in here and I'd start to watch you. I started to watch your eyes start to twinkle and your skin start to glow. And I started to watch your character change. And I can't see, feel, or touch your God, but I can see the effects of your God. And so I, you know, they said I could have this limited conception. So I picked the wind for a really long time. Because you see, I can't see, feel, or touch the wind. I can only see the effects of the wind. I could see the effects of the wind rippling through the leaves of a tree. I could feel the effects of the wind on my face. And the wind is so powerful, it can change a landscape. And the very thing that is changing you in your landscape, maybe I can work with this limited conception called the wind because it's so powerful. So I picked the wind until I could develop my own relationship. I could tell you the very paragraph on the very page that changed my life and changed my mind in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is on page 55. Deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. And it is there that he may be found. Later on, it says, in the last analysis, all the booze, the money, the men, all that human power could not satisfy. Could not satisfy the spiritual malady. No human power could relieve us of our alcoholism. I knew it because I'd had it before. I had that moment on my parents' front porch. And I knew it then, and I wanted it back, and I wanted it back now. It was like, what do I have to do? And they said, finish the steps, live your life on a spiritual basis. So I started to be actively involved in the steps and in fellowship and sponsoring and doing all that stuff. But I need to be reminded always, because here's what happened for me at 16 years sober. You see, that prayer says, relieve me of the bondage of self. It doesn't say, relieve me of the bondage of alcohol. It reminds me that I am the problem. And at 16 years sober, I had gotten a job when I was 2 months sober, right out of the detox, and I was unemployed for a little bit, and I went down to a temp service, and the temp service brought me on as a file clerk. So I'm 2 months sober, I'm a file clerk, and they put me into a global corporation. And through some hard work and some good work ethics and values instilled by my parents, I worked hard and I showed, you know, my true colors showed, and I was worthy of hire. So the global corporation hired me on out of the temp service. And I started to climb that corporate ladder like I said and knew I would. And I start getting promotions. I went to school, I got a degree, and I start climbing that corporate ladder. At 16 years sober, I'm the senior manager of a global corporation. And I got some prestige, I got a title, and I got a pocketbook to back it. And I start treating my employees, because now I have some subordinates, and I start treating them with rudeness and curtness and disdain and condescending. And they don't like that so much. And they take me to HR. And they got me written up. And I was appalled. And I was dumbfounded. I had no idea what had happened. I had never been written up in my entire working career. And now I'm written up at this level, don't you know? And so I signed the write-up. But you know, that fear is an evil corroding thread. And it permeated and dominated my entire life. Fear I'm going to lose this job. because now I'm been written up. Fear I'm going to lose this job. Fear of financial insecurity. And here's what happens with fear. Fear starts to roll out into my family life. Fear starts to roll out into my sponsees. Fear rolls out into my friends. What's happening is I am spraying this fear around. I'm taking you hostage. I don't want you to know what they did, and they're the problem. They're more the problem. I'm not to blame. They are the problem. And eventually that fear circles right back into work, and I start treating my employees with rudeness and curtness and disdain, and I'm condescending. And at 16 years sober, through a series of events, I am terminated in sobriety. 16 years sober, and I am on the ground in a fetal position with bubbles coming out of my mouth. I don't know what happened. I did not drink. I stayed sober. But I had no idea what had just happened. I know now. You see, I was tapping in and I was plugging into the wrong power. It was human power, pocketbook and prestige. But I had no idea that was happening. I was still going to meetings. I had sponsees. I was, doing the stuff, all this stuff, until I walked into that building, and that building became my power. And I could be all prayed up, getting into that elevator, and by the time that first email or that first phone call came, I was power. And they, and it was just this whole power thing. So I'm on my knees in a fetal position, and I have no idea what's happening. And the only thing I could do was send a text. And I sent a text to a mass group of people, and one of my friends called me up. I'd made it home because I worked in quite a distance away. I made it home, and she called me up, and she said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Do you want to go to a meeting?" And I said, "Yes." That was all I could manage to muster up. And she came by and picked me up, and we went to a meeting, a midday meeting in the middle of the week. It was Wednesday, and it was at midday, and she picked me up, and she basically we escorted me into this meeting. And the only thing I remember about this meeting was that there was a lot of chatter going on. It was a women's meeting, and they were just, settling down, and there was chatter going on, and they were saying hello, and then they got quiet, and the meeting started. I heard nothing, except from the left of my peripheral, I saw this gray cloud come by, and it was gray. And all I heard was, "Welcome." And I'm like, "Welcome to unemployment?" And I backtracked, and what came to me next, what I think was hopefully the Spirit of God, was, "Welcome to the next phase of your development. Your development." So I started on a new path, and here's what happened. So I consulted a friend who leads a spiritual retreat for men, and with the permission of his wife, we did that spiritual retreat work in his house. And so he brought me to this line in the big book that I never knew was there. This book was printed in 1939, and nothing's ever changed. And I had totally missed this line. And it says, the wording was, of course, quite optional so long as we expressed the idea of voicing without reservation. He said, "Write your own third step prayer. Write your own third step prayer." And I was in the middle of a Mount Albertson's parking lot. I was writing my own third step prayer, and I was cracked wide open for a brand new experience. Brand new experience. I'm not going to go through 4 through 9, because I fly. But I'm going to talk about 10, 11, and 12. Why? Because I wasn't doing it. See, 10, 10 has some instructions. We can pray and meditate our way, all the way through. And, "Oh, I prayed about it, I meditated." But there's some action I need to take. And that's in 10. 10 says continue 4 times. Continue. 4 times, 1 paragraph. It gives us specific directions. When these crop up. It says continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up. Not if, when. They will and they will. They will and they will. And so one of the things that I do is sometimes I can't get down to that selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear quick enough. Sometimes I can't find it. But what I can do is I ask myself these 5 questions. Like, do I have a need to control the person or the situation? Do I have a need to be right? Do I have a need to be heard? Do I have a need to be liked? Do I have a need to know? And if I can answer, yes to any one of those 5 questions, I can drill it down. Usually I can find the self-centeredness. Usually I can find the fear. I can find some dishonesty. You see, If I don't do this work, my external behavior is a result of my internal condition. And if I'm not careful, I can get corked up pretty much every day. And somebody will pay a price. Because we know that if I have a resentment and I have a fear, it's coming out in my conduct somewhere. And somebody's paying a price, and it's usually not the person I have a resentment with. And so my external behavior is a result of my internal condition. And I never knew. It's like, what's it, you know, it says, this is how we react so long as we're in fit spiritual condition. 5 lines later, it says, we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I'm like, what's the condition? And they said, unblocked. We do this work intent to keep the channel open for grace to continue to flow. Because if not, I get corked up, I'm popping somewhere. And it happens pretty much every day. I do silent scorn really well. Sometimes we unmask gossip as judgment. We can be judgy. We can be gossipy. Am I really, practicing the spiritual principles? Love, forgiveness, harmony, truth, light, joy, faith, hope, comfort, understanding, and love. Are we practicing? Are we practicing that? My sponsor, my deceased sponsor, she was 81 years old, 36 years of sobriety when she died. And she'd tell me, you know, step 11 was her favorite. Why? You know, she was doing 4 hours of prayer and meditation. She's like, I did 4 hours of prayer and meditation. I'm like, you're 81 and you can. But she always reminded me, she said, you know, the 11th step, she said, the 11th step is what I'm really doing is I'm fulfilling my commitment to the decision I made in step 3. I'm fulfilling that commitment. She said, Dawn, we ask God in the morning. She says, if you don't ask God in the morning, it's your first act of self-will. Right? And then she said, and she'd say, if you seek God in the morning, you don't have to seek him the rest of the day. You know, we know how to pray. One of the things we often shortchange ourselves on is meditate. You see, I meditate. I mean, I drank for the effect, so we meditate for the effect, even if it's just starting out with 30 seconds. Meditation is the medication from a malady. How do you like that little jingle? Meditation is a medication for my malady. I know you're going to go home with it. You know, and we talk about, you know, that power that is accessible and we can never be separated from it. We do that through our 11th step. We access it. You know, the words in our steps say improve. I always like to look up the words. And improve means make better. Enhance that which was already there. What I came here looking for, I came looking with. All I'm asked to do is just shine it up. Improve that which was already there. Had already told me that deep down in every man, woman, and child. It's there, just shine it up. And so we talk about, you know, the step 12 is having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. It does not say as a result of my attendance. Because I did that too. I am here as a result of someone else doing God's work. And if I'm out there doing my 12-step work, it can become someone else's first step. My job is to walk over to the new person in the room or a new face. I just welcome them. You know, there's a 30-foot journey to walk over to the new face and say, hi, are you new to our meeting? Do you know where the coffee is? Do you know where the bathroom is? Do you need a hug? We just welcome them. We have recovered and been given the power to help others. Our job is to grab someone's hand and bring them out of the dark and put them on a path and be a light to guide the feet that are afraid. And then put their hand in the hand of God and leave it there and let them do that for someone else. Because we are all really here just to walk each other home. Just to walk each other home. I have several commitments, and one of the things that I do is I volunteer at an indigent detox. I take these women, I volunteer and go on shift, and we either drive them to meetings, or one of my favorite things I like to do is I take them out for walks with my dogs. And they find such joy in that, because it's now the simple things, you know, and they're a little bit more relaxed when the dogs are there, and we go out and I dubbed a prayer tree. So we're in the riverbed. We're in the riverbed, right? And there's this tree, a botanist had told me it was sick and whatnot, and so we pray at this tree for the health and restoration of the tree, and then for us, right? Anyhow, so we do this, and I said, look, my sponsor said you can pray anywhere. You're in a riverbed. Let's do that. So we do that, and the thing that moves me the most, that moves my soul, is to find out that those girls have, you know, gone on, they've left, and there's 30, 60, 70, you know, 90 days sober, and they come back, and they volunteer. And they said, and I'll ask the girls, hey, have you been on a walk? Oh, yeah, so-and-so took us on a walk. And they said, they took us to your prayer tree. And it's like, we never know whose lives will affect, right? We plant the seeds. We just don't know where they're gonna bloom, right? Anyway, those are just the flowers of that kind of service work. I was 5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when I heard the promises delivered. I've been to meetings. And I'd never heard the promises until I was 5 years sober. I was in Durban, South Africa, and this woman in her Afrikaans delivered the promises in a manner in which sunk into my soul. And I realized that those promises all dealt with the mind. They all dealt with the mind. I also realized at 5 years sober that I never did have any kids. That my 30s were great because I got sober when I was 29 and a half years old. My 30s were great, my 40s were great, I'm mid-50s now. All right, I'm 54. So, and my 50s are great. And I've been able to travel the world. It has never been through business. It has always been through some opportunities, and we've, you know, paid our ways, but those opportunities were presented themselves, and we went. I mean, there were just random things. Been to China and South Africa and France and Ireland and Fiji and Honduras and Canada. All, you know, we've been many, many places, and always, wherever we have traveled, we have always been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes the language is not English, but I know it's the language of the heart. And we just sit there and we know what they're saying. Don't even have to understand it. I know what they're saying. I can feel it. So we've been able to travel to meetings all over the world, and one of the times I want to tell you about my experience in China. So we're in China, and we went to the Great Wall, and in the Great Wall of China, you have this opportunity. You have this bus driver said, listen, if you get off the bus and you go to the left, you can see that it's a very, very easy climb. It's very, very congested. You can't get very far on the wall, but you could say you're on the Great Wall of China. Or you can get off and you go to the right, and you can see that there is nobody on the wall. It's a very difficult climb. Listen, take your pick, we'll see you at 3. So what do we choose? We choose the difficult climb. So we go on over there, and so we start climbing this wall, and there's nobody on it, and we're just hiking a little bit, and I'm like, oh my God, and it starts to, I lost my breath. I said, hold on just a minute, I just gotta catch my breath. Okay. All right, let's keep going. So we keep going a little bit, and Steve, my husband, he spoke here a couple of weeks ago, and he wasn't my husband at the time, but he said, I said, well, can you push me? Can you pull me? Can you help me up a little bit? He's like, I'll do what I can. So he starts to push me up a little bit further on the Great Wall of China. Has anybody ever been there? If you guys know what I'm talking about, right? So you're gonna probably agree with me that there is no quality control back then, and there was no consistency. So the steps are this wide, this high, that high. It's an optical illusion of the incline. It was bad. So anyway, he starts pushing me up, and I said, okay, just stop for a minute, and let me catch my breath, and let me get some strength. So he goes, okay, so we stop, and Said, all right, let's keep going. So we climbed up a little bit further and we got to this plateau. And at the plateau, I looked over and there was this this vision. And if you've ever seen that postcard of the Great Wall of China and you see it wrapped around for miles and nobody's on it, that is the vision that I received. And I was like, dang. I dropped my knees on the Great Wall of China. I said, dear God, in my wildest dreams, I had never imagined I would ever be on the Great Wall of China. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you. And what came back to me was this. These are the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I have to stop and catch my breath. Sometimes I just got to stop and ask for help. Can you help me with this 4-step? Can you give me some 9-step amends suggestions? How about some 11-step prayer meditation suggestions? Sometimes we just got to stop and ask for help. Sometimes I just got to stop and regroup and get the courage and the strength to move on. And on that wall, on my knees, I realized I had finally achieved the level of Eileen's peace, that lady in the aftercare program. You know, each and every time that I apply the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they have always provided me a quiet mind, a skip in my step, and joy in my heart, and peace in my soul. And I hope and pray they do for you too. And then grab someone's hand and bring them out of the dark and put them on a path and be a light. And may we awaken and live. Thanks.
All right, let's give Don another round of applause.